Morning, everybody. I'd like to go ahead and call the Senate Finance Committee to order. Time is 1 minute after 9 a.m. Monday, February 27th, 2012. With me today is Senator Ellis, Senator Olson, Senator Thomas, Senator Egan, and we may be joined by our colleagues here, depending on the weather, in an hour or so, but we may be done by the time. We have one bill on the agenda today, followed by an overview of a state energy project. The bill is Senate Bill 170, Vocational Ed, Counseling in Schools. Senate Bill 170 by Senator Thomas regarding vocational education, counseling in schools. This is the first hearing on this bill. The intent today is to have the sponsor introduce the bill, take public testimony, and then we'll set the bill aside for further review. And with us today is, of course, Senator Thomas, one of our committee members, and if he wants to sit at the end of the table and present his bill, that would be fine.
I moved out here to get a different perspective on things here, just to know that.
Go ahead and introduce yourself for the record and who you represent.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, Senator Joe Thomas, District D. Thank you for hearing this bill this morning. SB 170 is a relatively simple bill. It's one of major efforts of our schools is obviously to prepare our children for the workforce. Most of our schools are doing a pretty fair job at that. We appreciate the hard work that they do. They offer a wide variety of programs to help kids investigate what kinds of jobs they want to do and when they graduate. And we have heard from many schools about how helpful SB 84 was, which was a vocational money from last year. However, not every school offers a comprehensive vocational counseling program. Senate Bill 170 assures that our young people will have the tools they need to make career choices by offering career counseling in the 7th, 9th, and 11th grades. If a school already has a program in place, this doesn't affect that. They can keep their program in place as long as it meets the minimum requirements. Focusing kids on their education and potential careers is probably more important today than it had ever been in the past and will be increasingly important going forward. Oftentimes, a student's own concept of a particular career or their knowledge of an occupation is not well-founded or based on accurate knowledge or information of a specific career. You probably all remember when you were a young kid, mostly boys here, you all wanted to be a fireman. And then at a later date, your thoughts change on those types of careers. And that is the issue that we're dealing with. And we're dealing with it at a point in time when kids are making some important decisions going forward as just what they do want to be and how well they understand that particular vocation or technical job, whatever it might be. SB 170 starts in the seventh grade, as I said, and that's the time when kids begin to make those critical choices. The ninth grade is when they start high school, and if they have an idea of what they want to do, they may need a lot of help in choosing the correct courses going forward. We've heard a lot of discussion over the past few years regarding kids getting to college and not really knowing what they want to do, if in fact they get onto college, or dropping out early because they're not really aware of what kind of education and what kind of skills they need to take on either technical or vocational jobs. So that is a big concern, and that's what the counseling will have a huge impact on, making sure they understand so that somebody doesn't drop out of school at the age of 16 or 17 and find that they are not going to be able to go to work, not only because of their age as a construction in some construction trade, but they don't have nearly the background in math or some sciences to accomplish that particular trade. We don't want them to miss out on that opportunity in middle school and high school to understand exactly what it takes to get where they're going. As I said, many schools are already offering this for all secondary students, but it should be available for every student in our state, and we believe that driving it down into the middle schools is extremely important because that's when some of those decisions are made just where they're headed or think that's where they're headed. The Department of Education and Early Development has indicated in their fiscal note that they already have the resources they need to carry this out. It is vital that we give our children the tools they need to prepare for their future and to become a productive member of our workforce. Senate Bill 170 provides this for all of our students, and I would appreciate your consideration and support of this bill.
We have any initial Questions for Senator Thomas? We have 1-0 fiscal note on this bill. Seeing no initial questions, we'll go ahead and start the public hearing process. And we'll start with the off-net. We've got two people signed up. We'll start with Suzanne Armstrong. If you could please identify yourself and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
Thank you. Good morning, Co-Chairman Stedman and members of the Senate Finance Committee. For the record, my name is Suzanne Armstrong, and I'm the president of the Associated Builders and Contractors of Alaska. ABC of Alaska supports Senate Bill 170, and we'd like to take this opportunity to thank Senator Thomas and to actually the entire legislature for the commitment and focus that you've shown for improving and growing vocational technical education opportunities in our schools, beginning last year with Senate Bill 84 and then continuing this year with Senate Bill 170. As a member association that represents contractors and subcontractors in Alaska, we're constantly looking for solutions for key problems that plague the construction industry, two of which are the high level of demand for skilled workers and an aging construction workforce. For the members of our association, we see the possibility of Senate Bill 170 is a great way to start engaging Alaskan youth in grades 7, 9, and 11 about the opportunities that exist in the construction industry, as well as other vocational and technical career paths. Whether these educational opportunities exist through AvTech, regional training centers, or even through registered apprenticeship programs, it's important that these students are presented the information and encouraged to explore these career opportunities. And as Senator Thomas mentioned, also the skills that they will need to succeed in these opportunities after they leave our public schools, such as math. Now, ABC of Alaska in particular is committed to ensuring that the construction industry in Alaska is supplied with a qualified workforce. Our registered apprenticeship program was started in 2001, and since then, over 300 apprentices have completed the program. They've completed coursework and on-the-job training in electrical, plumbing, carpentry, sheet metal, HVAC, sprinkler fitting, and electronic systems. We actively participate in job fairs, speaking with secondary school classes, providing orientation and informational sessions on apprenticeship in the crafts and trades in order to reach out and really educate young Alaskans about opportunities in the construction industry. We see Senate Bill 170 as an amazing complement to the efforts that are already being undertaken by the construction industry to educate young Alaskans about the possibilities, recruit, and then train up a qualified workforce. So in closing, we believe that Senate Bill 170 is a great start to educating young Alaskans about careers, not only in the construction industry, but in other trades and professions.
Okay, thank you for your testimony this morning.
Thank you.
Next up, Shelley Berry, please.
Hello?
Yes, if you can identify yourself for the record and who you represent and speak to the bill, please.
I apologize. There was just a loud beep in my ear when you were saying that. My name is Shelley Berry. I'm the College and Career Ready Coordinator for the Anchorage School District. I am a longtime teacher in ASD and a longtime counselor as well. This is my third year in working with our middle school career guides who work directly with our students in developing their own personal learning and career plan. They have also headed up the Explore test, which gives them not only some academic information, but a very clear career opportunity to look at the career pathways as well as the career clusters that they would be looking perhaps at for themselves, or it would also show them some areas in which they are very talented in. This is such an important bill for these youngsters. We are just beginning to bring everything together. We're working very well in addition with our at-risk students who are beginning to see that they have a vision and can set goals to reach it. This is all in sync with the state CTE plan. It is critical that we help our middle school students be more purposeful in their endeavors throughout their education so that they have a post-secondary plan. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes our off-net. We have nobody signed up in the LIOs and nobody signed up in the room to testify. We'll bring it back to the – oh, excuse me, we do have one. Barbara Huff. I read that as respond to questions. I wasn't paying as much attention as I should have. don't be shy. Raise your hand if I misread the forms.
Well, I was watching. good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is Barbara Huff-Teknas. I'm the Director of Governmental and Legislative Affairs for Teamsters Local 959, and I want to go on record supporting Senate Bill 170. We have a training and trust program that actually has been established since 1972 under the original Taft-Hartley Act. We have five different training programs, including the tech engineer survey programs, construction driving, as well as the truck bus, mechanic and diesel engine, including the logistic technician and also the freight over the road programs. And over the years, one thing that we continue to see as we get new students enrolled in our program, whether it's existing members that are moving from maybe one industry into a new industry or our younger members coming into the field, that their math skills in particular, especially with some of our surveying in particular, some of the diesel engine requirements in these particular fields severely are lacking. It takes a lot of time going back. We actually end up sending a lot of our students back through additional training programs before they're ever able to start participating in the apprenticeship programs themselves. Senate Bill 170, we believe, will help set the tone as these kids are in school and moving through the system in a proactive manner to hopefully get those who are looking at a technical avenue versus college-bound actively involved in these programs so that we can get them trained and get them into new work opportunities within the state. And we thank you for hearing the bill.
Okay. Thank you. That concludes, I guess, our testimony. Is there anybody else that wants to testify that I missed? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go ahead and bring it back. Any final questions from the committee members, comments by the bill sponsor before we set this bill aside for further review?
Mr. Chairman, just that I think the testimony was good, and I believe that narrowing our focus and moving it down into the middle school, I think, is extremely important, because I believe that going forward, a lot of kids do not realize exactly what it's going to take, and at a later date, they find out when it's almost too late to get that education and get focused as to what kind of careers they're looking into. So thank you for hearing this bill today.
We'll go ahead and set that bill aside for further review. Next up. We're going to have, we've invited the Alaska Energy Authority and the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation to update the committee on projects the state has invested in to address the high cost of energy in Alaska. This is the committee's sixth hearing on the FY13 capital budget and related projects. With us today is Ms. Sarah Fisher Goad, Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. She could come forward and get set up, and then we'll go from there. Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For the record, I'm Sarah Fisher Goad, the Executive Director of the Alaska Energy Authority. We're waiting for the computer to get hooked up with the PowerPoint presentation. I know that the committee has hard copies in front of them. And,
we can have a brief at ease while we warm up the old machine. We're at ease. Kurt, go ahead and continue, please.
Sure. Mr. Chairman, we have a short PowerPoint presentation with respect to the program status of the Renewable Energy Fund, and I'm going to turn it over to Peter Crimp in just a second. I just want to one slide I wanted to show this committee. Although this presentation is primarily about the Renewable Energy Fund, I did want to include this slide to show that we, for renewables and other projects, this is just a five-year state fund snapshot with respect to renewable energy funds of $176.6 million and 310 projects. But there are other state funds that have been appropriated for AEA to manage projects and grants of $249 million. So although the Renewable Energy Fund is a significant part of the Alaska Energy Authority work on the renewable and alternative energy, what we do have is several other funding sources and other projects. And in particular, the energy efficiency section is included in this. The one thing I'll note on the energy efficiency, that although there's $3.4 million of other state funds, most of the significant work that we've been working with under energy efficiency has actually been federal funds, and that we were working through the stimulus funds and the ERA funds that have been provided to AEA for the past several years. And with that, I'm going to turn it over to Peter Crimp to work through the Renewable Energy Fund presentation.
Good morning. For the record, I'm Peter Crimp, Deputy Director of Alternative Energy and Energy Efficiency at AEA. And this table shows the statistics. Okay. Shows the statistics for the Renewable Energy Fund to date. Gives a lot of detail, but I'll just summarize going over to the total column. First off, we're on our fifth round of the grant program. We've received 558 applications, funded 208 of them, and grants are in place for 165. Right now, the round five of the Renewable Energy Fund is up for consideration. The four round five, AEA's recommended up to $43.2 million, and at this point, the appropriations, of course, are not established. In terms of what has been appropriated, $177 million to date for the RE fund, and out of that, approximately $81 million has been disbursed as of February 17 of this month. You can see there's a substantial amount of match provided, which are in the grants and other contributions. And as before, we are reallocating funds, dollars for funds that have not moved forward in the time frame that has been established or that have run into snags.
Maybe before you go to your next slide, I think what we'll do is we'll have you present the slides, and then if we have questions, we'll ask them at the end of the slide rather than the end of the presentation. But depending on your format or your presentation and when you want to do it, I think the committee would be very interested in the cost benefit comparison throughout the region, and in particular the benefit to the communities that the funds were directed in. As an example, if we put in a wind turbine in one of our communities, what's been the effect of the price per kilowatt to that community? Not only the diesel savings, which is just one component of it, but the committee is concerned that there isn't enough downward pressure on the cost of energy in the community themselves. And I think that concern has been expressed to me, too, by the administration. So if you can kind of help us, through your presentation, pointing out that, and then where you feel you may want to come back with more information to the committee on that issue.
Mr. Chairman, I do have information that I have prepared on that topic of benefit versus cost for wind projects and other two, further on the presentation.
Okay. You go ahead and continue.
Okay. Next slide shows the drawdown, and as I said, approximately $81 million to date. This graph shows the differentiation among feasibility, reconnaissance stage work versus final design and construction. Generally speaking, 70 to 80% of the funding is going into construction for the projects, and you can see the slope of the curve increases pretty much during the construction season when funds are expended more quickly. We'll go on to the next slide. At the end of 2011, we had 60 projects that were complete, and this slide shows what the that was 58 projects complete, and by the end of the next year, as you, this bar charts show a projection of the completion of the projects.
Do we, if I could, as a policy, do we go back under the completed projects? Is it, does the department go back and re-examine the viability and the benefits of the particular projects to help us out going forward into fine-tuning, you know, the projects that we're looking at? How can you inform the committee how that works?
Sure, Mr. Chairman. The AEA finds that we have a very robust program to actually obtain the metrics for the project's performance, dollars saved, and you'll see some slides afterwards, but we have established reporting formats quarterly for all of the projects that they need to let us know what the kilowatt hours production has been, the millions of BTUs production, operation and maintenance costs, downtime, et cetera. For projects such as hydro and biomass, that's fairly straightforward. For wind projects, a little less so, since that is an intermittent energy source. However, we have been collecting that, and the numbers I have further on my presentation will pretty much show the data that we've collected.
Okay. Let the record reflect that Senator McGuire has joined us.
Just for reference sake, there are two maps here that show the distribution of projects throughout the state by the various renewable energy resources. The first slide is pre-construction projects, and this, of course, is just rounds 1 through 4. You can see a pretty good distribution from southeast up to the north slope to the Aleutian chain. Much of south central and southeast focuses on hydroelectric. More in western Alaska, and these are for reconnaissance and feasibility studies. Western Alaska more in wind energy, although there have been in the past fairly substantial wind projects being studied in the interior too. And there is a bar chart up at the top, and that shows the allocation among construction, recon, and feasibility and final design. And then the second slide shows construction projects throughout the state, and I'd be happy to talk about any of these as well as I can. Again, similar distribution, biomass in the interior in terms of projects that are under construction or that have been completed. Hydroelectric more in southeast. There is a hydro in the Aleutian chain in Atka, too. In terms of allocation, a couple of pie charts just to show the allocation among PC and non-PC communities. You can see about 72% of the funds so far have gone to PCE communities, whereas 28% have not. They're in the non-PCE communities. What we have found as part of an NGO study that AEA has sponsored with our partners versus in the heat and power topic is that much of the heat, probably around 80% of the energy that's used in Alaska, is for heat. That is the residential, commercial, non-transportation energy. The Renewable Energy Fund Advisory Committee has instructed us to emphasize heat, or advised us, I should say, to emphasize heat projects, and that is what we're doing. In the round five, many of the projects are biomass and heat recovery projects. They generally are have the best bang for the buck, although they are smaller. So we are emphasizing those and have begun to do so in round five more so.
If we could, maybe you can define for those watching at home, what is the difference between the PCE and the non-PEC and
PCE community?
Right.
Well, the power cost equalization communities, the communities that receive the power cost equalization payments for their power. And then the non-PC communities such as Anchorage, Juneau, Fairbanks, the old Four Dam Pool communities, they are non-PC communities.
So basically the communities that are on diesel-generated power, the state helps subsidize the residential power consumption at home with the first, I think it's 1,000 kilowatts, 1,500?
Mr. Chairman, the definition of the eligible PCE utility is actually goes back to about 1985 with respect to whether they are generating with diesel or not in 1985. So yes, you're correct that it's primarily the communities that generate from diesel. However, there are communities that are still eligible, or utilities that are eligible for PCE, even though they may have transition to other resources. Cordova Electric is an example of a PCE-eligible community, but they also have hydroelectric power in their community. So it's based upon the statutory definition. In addition, the Four Dam Pool communities, Wrangell, Petersburg, Ketchikan, and
Kodiak, and
the Copper Valley Electric Association region are not eligible due to the state construction of the Four Dam Pool projects. So it does go back to a 1985 definition, and it's the first 500 kilowatt hours per month for residential customers, and then there's a calculation for community facilities, and commercial entities and schools are not eligible for PCE payment. The PCE communities, roughly the kilowatt hours produced in a community is about 30% that would be eligible for PCE. So where there is a project that is constructed that can provide diesel displacement and fuel savings, that impacts 100% of the kilowatt hours in a community, whereas PCE only represents this 30% or so in a community.
PCE is the first 1,000 kilowatts, isn't it?
It's the first 500.
First 500? Okay. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. What was the statistic you gave again on the issue of heat being 80% of the issue?
For the chair, Senator Thomas, these are preliminary results. AEA has commissioned an NGO study. My recollection is 80% or so of the energy which is used throughout the state, non-transportation, is for heat. Now, that's not the value of the energy. The value of electrical energy is much higher. So, but when it comes to addressing some of the problems in rural areas, AEA has found that heat is a very important sector that we need to focus on.
And we find that, Mr. Chairman, we find that in the interior, obviously, it's 60-some percent is what we calculate is the issue. So any emphasis you can put on that, I think the people that are, you know, the people as they look at their energy bill, they understand the difference. And the issue, so I think that it would be good as we look at projects that are coming forward. I realize You have tough decisions to make with those, but emphasizing to folks that that is probably the real issue that should be taken up is the heat. The electricity is certainly expensive depending on where you are throughout the state as well, but the heat is the primary one, at least in most of the communities I'm familiar with. Thank you.
On to the next slide, which shows the actual and annual fuel savings. You can see the fuel savings from 2009 to 2011. These are actual figures, unfortunately, I did not come equipped to give you the total of the 3 years. I do remember the value of the 2009 to 2011, and that's approximately $11.7 million. Now, we use fuel savings as the broadest metric for the Renewable Energy Fund. And we understand that when it comes right down to it, what we really care about are savings to the ratepayers and the customers. However, in order to have a broad metric that is not subject to the year-to-year variability in the cost of fuel, we find this useful. I am ready to talk further on down the in this presentation for the communities and the projects, so we know what the actual savings are per kilowatt hour, for instance. In 2012, we're expecting, you can see the cumulative fuel savings, and this is in terms of millions of gallons of diesel equivalent, because starting in 2014, there's a lot of natural gas which is being displaced, so we just provide the equivalent there. You can see a large jump between 2013 and 2014 in diesel displacement, and that's mostly due to Golden Valley Electric's Eva Creek project and the municipality of Anchorage's landfill gas to power project. They're much larger projects, and they have substantial displacement.
And then maybe if you could
talk
a little bit, you know, you mentioned that even though you don't have the breakdown of 9, 10, and 11, the actual numbers, you recall it was like $11.7 million expenditures on the state side, as I heard your comment, on savings, $11.7 million in diesel equivalent per year, I guess, total for those 3 years. What did it cost the state to attain those savings?
Right. If I could wait till I have a slide that shows benefit to cost on those. I may have to wait till that slide if I could, Mr. Chair.
That's fine. Senator Thomas.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. In the going out the years 14, 15, 16, and 17, what accounts for just the flattening out so much of the biomass, geothermal, heat recovery, and to some degree hydro, actually, but the first three, can you explain that to me a little bit?
Yeah, through the chair, Senator Thomas. Basically, the projects have been built out at that point, and they will just be saving that there are no new projects. So that is the fuel which is being displaced on an annual basis. In terms of cumulative over the years, then, of course, that graph continues to go up, but this is the gallons per year. So we're somewhere around 11.5 million gallons of diesel displacement per year after all the projects are built out.
So if I understand it correctly, then, and that makes sense now that you mentioned that, because you're dealing only with the projects that you listed on page two as far as they're not anticipating anything new. So okay,
that's correct.
Thank you.
Go ahead and continue.
And this slide just shows the breakdown for the scheduled construction projects, how much Renewable Energy Fund grants have gone into the projects versus the total expenditures. And You can see there's a very significant non-state and local match compared to the Renewable Energy Fund dollars. I have gone on to this slide entitled Energy Production and Diesel Cost Savings 2011, and this slide shows the projects for which that have been in operation at least before January 1, 2011. So this gives the energy production and cost savings in 2011 for the projects for which we have a full year's worth of data. This data is simply that. There are no projections, no major assumptions. This is simply what the projects have produced. And you can see the totals down below. They are separated by the resource area. In terms of energy performance, which is the first set of columns, what AEA has done is set the goals for energy production based on the original grant application. And you can see what the amount of, and we're using diesel displacement. Following this slide, I will go in a little bit to the best data that we have for savings to consumers. But sticking with the diesel displacement metric, generally speaking, if you go down to the total, the projects are producing at about 84% of what the initial goal was as established in the grant application. Therefore, these particular projects in 2011 displaced 1.7 4 million gallons of diesel, i.e. 84% of the goal. If you go to the second set of columns, which shows economic performance, and Mr. Chairman, this is where the cost of the projects, the total cost and the Renewable Energy Fund dollars are shown. So again, just going down to the total, for the total cost of these projects was 55.6, not subsidized by the Renewable Energy Fund, just the total project cost. The fuel savings for 2011 in terms of dollars were $4.9 million. That just gives a simple payback on the 55.6 divided by the 4.9 of approximately 11 years. Now, that does not take into account operation and maintenance costs, but it is fair to say that the fuel cost is the lion's share of the operational costs. When you look at the Renewable Energy Fund portion of that, the $20.6 million for those projects cost, given that $4.9 million per year, or $4.9 million savings for 2011, it's approximately a four-year payback. So a four-year payback on state funds, 11-year payback on the entire project cost. And these are projects that range usually around 20 years for thermal projects, 50 years for hydroelectric. There is only one hydro there.
So is the goal to save diesel fuel or to stabilize and move down the cost of energy to the communities? What's the underlying goal that you're operating under?
Well, the way we read the goal is to bring down the cost to communities and to ratepayers and consumers.
Okay. Was that coming attractions in your presentation?
We have I can give you some the best numbers we have. They're not in this presentation. We do have, and if I can. Why don't I just go on to a few of the projects that we do have. This is in a separate report, partial for 2011, that we prepared in November. We will update that program or that that report and provide that. And I guess I should also say that AEA has commissioned an independent evaluation of the program and by a third party, and that third party will provide those numbers separately.
Let me, if I could, just to make the point, let me pick on one of the, or point out one of the projects in my own district.
Sure.
As an example of challenges that we face dealing with this. In Wrangell, we helped the community convert from oil boiler to electric boilers, and shows a savings here, FY11 fuel savings of $230,000, which is good on fuel, but then they have to turn around and buy electricity, so the net spread, and I don't know what they're buying their oil for in Wrangell, but just off the top of my head, I recall that about a $4 price of oil at 82% efficiency is roughly 12 cents a kilowatt. And I think, though, so if they're going to have to get their kilowatt purchase price down, I think SEPA's wholesale rate 6.7 cents. And I don't know what the arrangement SEPA has, the local generation there with the city of Wrangell, you know, what they're charging Wrangell per kilowatt hour. Certainly can't be lower than their wholesale cost. So it's somewhere probably 7 cents in north. So you start measuring that spread, and then you factor in the next piece of the complexity is increased hydro generation for the consumption of the electricity. I'm just struggling with this whole cost benefit because it's much more complex than just saving diesel fuel. So can you help me walk through that?
Sure.
That's just one example. There's several on here that we can talk about.
For Wrangell, I do have the figures from the work we did last year. Wrangell paid 8 cents per kilowatt hour for the power, and that equates to $2.22 per gallon of fuel oil. But at that point, the city borough of Wrangell was paying $3.49, and so that spread, given the amount of energy they used, was approximately $61,000 in savings to Wrangell. But I think the larger issue, Mr. Chairman, is what you brought up about the diminishing excess amount of hydropower in the southern southeast. And the Southeast Regional Energy Plan has identified the fuel conversions as an issue. This project was funded, recommended for funding in 2009, I think before we all had identified that as a major issue.
Let me add a little bit to that, because just, and that, if, and I think it's pretty close, 12 cents a kilowatt at 12 cents a kilowatt at 100% efficiency is about equal to, ballpark, pretty close to $4 oil at 82% efficiency. So assume that their boilers are 82% efficient, which is an assumption, maybe they're 90, I don't know.
Sure.
But you go from 12 to 8, you knock off a quarter of it, you take a dollar off of the $4, you're at $3. I would want to see the analysis back and forth to actually see the net savings there. Granted, today oil prices are higher, but just in the static world, if they have oil at $3, and unless they can get their oil price down, I just off the top of my head, I don't see much bang for the buck there at all. Not even counting the issue of having to build another hydro to suck, you know, to create more electricity.
Well, for the Wrangell boilers, we will be we'll provide the actual savings, the net savings after electricity, to you, and be happy to do that. I I think that is what needs to be done. Whether or not AEA would, if there were to be a round six of the Renewable Energy Fund, recommend funding for resistance electrical boilers versus ground source heat pumps or energy efficiency measures is a question.
The if we could do that, I think in that I'd like to see that concept, and I'm not excuse me trying to point out wrangles, no different than any other project here, just off the top of my head I'm kind of familiar with that process because it's going on in Petersburg and Ketchikan and Sitka and Juneau, and so it's clearly around that region, and I've had multiple discussions with AEA on this issue, how do we solve it. But I think we need to take a look at that actual spread issue, not only in the example here in Wrangell, but throughout the whole list here, and what is their alternatives, and are we actually completing a goal on a macro level, not just an isolated replacement of diesel fuel. And I understand the concern that the committee had, and I agree with it. We started several years ago, 4 years ago, when oil went to $140 a barrel. We started an aggressive movement here in the legislature that's been going on now for 5 years, trying to address this and get ahead of it as much as we can, and it appears today we're pretty close to $130 a barrel oil again. So I think we're on the right direction. I just want to make sure we stay focused so we don't end up having basically no net gain in the cost to the citizens and the state.
Mr. Chairman, I just want to add, too, and I agree with what you have stated. I guess the one thing that we have seen, that although this is four rounds of completed funding, what you have here is a subset of completed projects that have only 1 year of data. And so we are working with a limited set of completed projects that are actually giving us a full 1 year of data. So we do know that, but with this data, we know that there are things that we need to address. The Southeast issue with heat conversion to electricity is, as you had mentioned, it's a complicated issue because at some point or another, there are these hydro-rich regions with low-cost power, and as a consumer, it is definitely for pocketbook, it's easy to change to electric heat where you see that immediate benefit. However, when the electric utilities are then converting to supplement and have to generate that electricity with diesel, you then, of course, lose that savings and you're not displacing that diesel.
If we could just stop there for a minute. I want to be a little careful with the terminology because when I hear low-cost hydro in Southeast, I kind of stopped there because the cost at 12 cents a kilowatt, which is fairly close, and I looked at my utility bill here in Juneau, it was 13 cents per kilowatt by the time I paid everything on the fiddler's list, and I had to write a check and divide it by how much power I actually bought. A lot of the communities are right around 12 cents, 11 cents, 12 cents, 13 cents to the customer, which is pretty equivalent to $4 oil, which is about where oil is. So if 12 cents a kilowatt's cheap, then $4 oil's cheap, that's nonsensical because I don't think too many people agree $4 oil is cheap. And then when we look at Anchorage on natural gas, is about one-third that cost. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to keep it in comparison. So it's not only is hydro not cheap to construct, it's not cheap to the consumer, and it's steady in the long run. I think the consumer ends up, and the citizens ends up ahead of the game by building hydro over 20 and 30 and 40, 50 years. But 12 cents a kilowatt and $4 oil, I tell my wife, I don't care if you call for oil or you turn on the electric heat, bill's the same. So, because I hear that a lot about how cheap our hydro is. But let me switch over here and point out another project. I'll jump into the geothermal in the Juneau project, which we did as an experiment, a geothermal project at the Juneau Airport, a heat pump project, a ground source, total cost of about $1 million. We put in about 500 on the state side, about half, which is good. But I'd like to see a report back, more detailed information on that. I think there's a swimming pool also down here in the community, and that's kind of pilot projects. Pardon me?
It's another project.
I know. Right. There's the and the swimming pool is not at Thunder Mountain isn't, you know, I think we need probably more time to actually get a good handle on that. But those are high cost infrastructure, but it may benefit in the long run. And I know there's interest throughout the warmer areas of the state, southeast, to try to do some of these projects if they work. So the sooner we can find out if, you know, the Juneau Airport and the swimming pool here and the school is positive cost benefit, then we can put that as a potential solution for other areas around the state too, rather than, you know, because I get communities coming to me and asking me for those type of projects. I'm a little hesitant to jump on the bandwagon because it sounds like they should work, but I'd like to actually have these things run and find out if they actually work. And if you could respond, please.
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, actually the City Borough of Juneau has, for the airport ground source heat pump, has put out an excellent report and has found that that project is highly successful. It's is exceeding performance in terms of energy output, more energy output than was expected. The savings on it, I don't have them right here, but I will forward the report from the City and Borough of Juneau to the committee. The economics are quite good, less than a 10-year payback for actual savings on a project which has a 20-year life. So I'd be happy to send that. In terms of the Juneau Aquatic Center, we do not have data on that. The project was commissioned and has had the usual startup bugs during the summer. By the end of this year, though, they'll have very good data on it, and of course we'll forward that to the committee.
And if you could, when you get back to us on the heat pump on both those, particularly if there is some information ready to go on the airport, I'd like you to take a look at that. I don't know what that report is, but in detail, or even not in detail, but their objectives may be different from our objectives. So I want to make sure it fits our objectives. There's the mechanical question of, can you do it? Does it generate heat out of the ground? And you're saying that it's more successful than they anticipated, which is all well and good. But I'm concerned, is it a financial success? And is this the model we should be going forward with, maybe adjust it a little bit if it's, you know, 50%, if the state's 50% in on the cost or some other ratio, you know, or not. But if it's a 20-year life, then, you know, I want to make sure I'd be interested in the discount factors and the financial modeling that you're actually doing on the financial benefit.
Be happy to provide that, Senator. Would you like to talk about some of the other projects on this list too?
Sure.
Okay. The Gateway School District, starting at the top, the Toca Wood Heating Project. They shut that down for half of the year in order to install a steam turbine. They're planning to generate 50 to 60 kilowatts of power from that project. So the economic performance for this year is rather poor. It's about half of what it ought to be. We will get better numbers or more typical numbers by the end of the year. That goes to show, however, that this is a snapshot and it should be viewed as such. We're just reporting just the facts. Regarding the next one down, it's a wood processor splitting wood for using decked logs in Cordova, and that's highly successful. Although the actual versus the goal is not all that high, they displaced on the order of $42,000 worth of wood, much of it going to elders in Cordova. Gulcana Village Council, the numbers are rather poor on that one. It's not producing as much energy as we expected. Our project manager will be continuing to work with them to get the project up to snuff. We talked about the Juneau Airport. North Pole Heat Recovery Project has been working excellent. These numbers are Golden Valley's project is saved $172,000 worth of naphtha. It has very low operation and maintenance costs, so economics are very good on it. McGrath Light and Power saved $157,000 last year for the community, and again, that's a heat recovery unit, just a jacket water diesel heat recovery, fairly straightforward. They extended the loop to various community buildings, and that also has been working very well, very low operation and maintenance costs. And I could, if you wish, I could talk a little more about O&M, but I'll save that more for the wind projects, if I could. We talked about Wrangell. Then Gustavus Electric's Falls Creek project, that saved $483,000 worth of fuel last year. You find the actual savings to customers were 28 cents per kilowatt hour. That's before PCE. It's a kind of an interesting question. When you save dollars for a PC community, where do the savings go? Some of them just go back into the power cost equalization kitty for redistribution elsewhere because the price of power is lower. There's less PCE given to consumers. Moving down, McKinley Village Solar Thermal, Golden Valley Electric, that project has not worked up to snuff. Golden Valley is working with the project to figure out what's wrong. It appears to be the distribution system. They're very optimistic that the project will be a success. They need a year or two more. It's just run in the summer when there's actually sun there. And please interrupt me if you want more information, Mr. Chair. Kodiak Electric Pillar Mountain project has been highly successful. That saved $2.9 million in fuel last year. In terms of savings, last year when we did the analysis, it was saving 13.4 cents per kilowatt hour over the diesel generated kilowatt hours, so they were reducing costs in that way, and that was assuming $3 per gallon fuel. Obviously, the higher fuel goes, the more savings there are for all of these. The next one down is the Delta Area Wind. That's developed by an independent power producer, Alaska Environmental Power. They are selling power to the Golden Valley grid at average avoided cost. It is a wash, depending on how you calculate average avoided cost.
So define what a wash means.
It would be about a break even for the utility, but of course that the power that they average in to for the sales cost includes low cost coal and hydropower brought up from the south. So the cost is less than the naphtha-generated power that is generated at Golden Valley's North Pole units.
So then what I'm inferring then is there's really doesn't appear to be a net benefit. So is this one of these projects that get kind of red flags so we don't build a litany of these?
Mr. Chairman, I think a good approach would be to ask the project proponents to speak for themselves. When their message is carried through AEA, perhaps something is lost on it. You may wish to call them in and have some of the proponents talk. But yes, in terms of if the project is a break-even, assuming average avoided cost, and average avoided cost is the metric, yes, it raises the issue that you brought up.
I think every project's a good project when it's somebody else's money. So what we want to hear is from AEA, after they've had time to look at it and do the analysis on it and direct recommendations. I mean, if they're something that, you know, we try it doesn't work, then fine, but, you know, we'll go on and go after things that work. For instance, if the geothermal heat pumps work for these aquatic centers and big buildings, then let's, you know, go after them and run that analysis against hydro expansion and other things like that. But I have yet to see anybody that has come in my office in 6 years that I've sat at the Finance Committee, 7 years or so, that ever had a project that they didn't like when it was our money, the state's money.
Mr. Chairman, I totally agree with that. And the AEA has provided feedback from the performance of the completed projects to the project selection, and we feel that that is the best approach. For instance, if we're not getting as much production out of the wind projects, then for the assumptions we use for the economic life cycle analysis that's done on all the Renewable Energy Fund projects, we make it more conservative. And as a matter of fact, we did that in round five of the Renewable Energy Fund.
And just for those watching at home, this project appears to cost about $2.8 million, rounded off, $2.8 million. The state put in $2 million, which is a substantial, you know, almost two-thirds of the investment. Where the other 800 came from, I don't know, in this, you know, if it was actual cash on the table or it was, you know, some other mechanism that would inflate that number towards 2.8. So maybe you can get back at the committee. I'd like to actually find out where that 800 came from, 802. Just in curiosity. And I expect that, and I think we all expect here at the table, that when we aggressively go after a situation that the state faced, high energy costs several years ago, that we're going to have projects that don't materialize as we all hope they would. So that's certainly expected, but we just want to make sure that as these areas show up, that we move them out of the way and we concentrate on the stuff that's successful. And because I do get concerned that there's been a lot of shift in these arenas to the more theoretical end of the spectrum versus the proven hardcore technology we know that's going to work. Go ahead and continue.
Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
Thank you. Mr. Krimpa, I was wondering, you said this is a private venture. How much of that may be affecting the numbers that are there as opposed to if it was a public, totally a public utility that was overseeing?
Senator Olson, through the chair, that would be very difficult for me to assess. Golden Valley Electric did do a study between that considered its options for wind power that looked at expanding of this Delta wind farm versus going ahead with Golden Valley. They decided to go ahead with Golden Valley, but the particulars of the economics and their decision, I'm not able to address.
Mr. Chairman, and the reason I bring it up is we go down the list here, there's a project there with the Nome Joint Utilities, which is down at 28%, which is very concerning because I don't see any rate savings to the rate player that's there. And I realize that it's a privately owned project, but the concern is that public money are being put into something that doesn't really save anybody anything. I mean, you can get the more specifics on that, but those are the things that catch my attention.
And so if you can get back to the committee on a little bit more data on those the last two projects that Senator Olson mentioned, and that is a concern, but well, the last project, the Nome project, as an example, when we're using state funds in non-municipal-owned utilities or state organizations, when it starts getting out into the private sector, if there's no benefit to the Alaskan citizens, then we have to ask ourselves, what are we doing?
Mr. Chairman and Senator Olson, for the Nome Joint Utilities Banner Peak, the Renewable Energy Fund paid only for the transmission, the intertie from that farm. Right now, Nome Joint Utilities is moving forward with a recommended funding in round five for a 1.8 megawatt wind utility or wind project whose economics appear much better. And we should say which will use that same intertie. Now, the particular turbines that Banner Peak Wind is using, the integrities have had problems with tip breaks, and it has been a long-term situation. They think they're going to be able to improve that, but we understand the concern for putting money into projects that are not saving dollars, and we share that. We feel that the larger turbines that Nome Joint Utilities are going to be highly economic, however.
And that's on Newton Peak?
That is actually on Banner Peak. It started out on Newton, and they found a less icing around Banner, so they decided to site the turbines there.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Go ahead and continue.
Let's see. Tuksuk Wind Farm, I do not have the detailed information for that particular one. That was not available in 2011 when I did that. Unalakleet Wind is generating just about at the 600 kilowatt wind farm, just a little bit below goal. The economics should be better. Whether or not they pay back the dollars that were invested in, at least in 2011. The savings were 3.4 cents per kilowatt hour before PCE for all kilowatt hours that were produced in the wind and the utility. So it is bringing down the cost again. Many of those dollars are going into the PCE bucket too. I think that is pretty much at the bottom of the list. Any more questions on this one?
Senator Thomason.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I think what the chairman has brought up is extremely important because people are making decisions on what particular project in their area. Some are not feasible, obviously, but you know we have this fairly broad range of things that can take place. And I think the overall analysis that shows exactly with maintenance and everything taken into consideration is extremely important for people going forward to help them maybe even relocate a project that they were thinking because they thought they saw some success in one that you might have here. It looked good, but overall the savings were at the point where the project life meant you had to start over again almost, and basically over a 20-year period of time you may have saved nothing. So I think that's extremely important to get those so we can sort out some of the projects, and we have a broad range now, which is good, you know, which is helpful evaluating. And the other thing that I think should be factored into this, and I noticed on the front page or near the front page you had a and I don't know why that is, and you could probably explain it rather easily, the concept of energy efficiency, not necessarily calculated in, and I think that should be part of the whole discussion when people are planning projects, because we know there, again, there's cost-benefit analysis necessary. 25 to 30% is what the Alaska Housing indicates has been the overall savings, and I'm not sure if that's considering a real long-term cost-benefit analysis or not on the changes that have been made due to the weatherization programs.
Through the chair, Senator Thomas, we very much agree. Energy efficiency first. It only makes sense for the biomass projects that AEA has recommended. In our recommendations, we are recommending that the facilities do the changes to the heating, ventilation, HVAC system, and the other energy systems to make them more efficient before putting money into supply side fixes.
Before we continue, I just thought I'd make a comment while I'm thinking about it, because just for those watching at home, several years ago, as I mentioned, when oil hit about $140, the committee here got very aggressive and trying to alleviate the high cost of energy around the state, and we decided that we'd put $50 million a year forward in renewable energy. We'd also come in with a weatherization program with another $30 to $50 million a year, and we started shoving a lot of money down the table, which frankly overwhelmed a couple of the departments and took them a while to scramble and get organized, because we were pretty aggressive on trying to get to a solution, and so we appreciate the ability of the department to respond and absorb and do the work. So we understand there's been a lot of pretty high workload on AEA the last several years as we've rushed to try to get ahead of this. I just didn't want the people at home thinking that we're one, not aggressively trying to deal with the situation, or two, we're just going after, willy-nilly projects. That's not what's going on here at all. Go ahead. Continue.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. That's actually a nice segue into our last slide, which, through the years that we've managed this program, and one of the agencies that had to ramp up very quickly with especially a $100 million appropriation for that first year for our round one, we did have a significant workload, and there was a significant amount of pressure to get money out on the street for projects. And we did, through the process that was developed, I think the money may not have gotten out as fast as possible. What we were trying to do, though, is do a very thorough analysis of the applications that were proposed and making sure we're making the best decisions possible with the information in front of us on which project should go forward. And again, as you saw from the earlier slide, we have limited projects that are actually completed to provide us data. But that list, of course, is growing every day. We have several more completed projects, and next year we'll have definitely a lot more information on the performance of the projects from the prior slide, and then also new projects to add to that. One of the things that we've been looking at and developing is really looking at not renewable energy fund and those applications in an isolated incident. What we really need to do is make sure that we continue focusing on the entire energy system. We need to make sure that the systems are reliable and energy efficient, and make sure that energy efficiency is the first thing that we look at in a system. We've had certain circumstances, especially in rural Alaska and in communities that we work very closely with, to develop a bulk fuel tank farm or an RPSU, or a rural power system project, where a community wants to put in a wind system. However, we may not have been in that community yet to rebuild or upgrade the power system. So what we really want to do through our planning efforts is to make sure that we are assisting in the project development for renewable projects, and making sure that we can integrate a diesel into a diesel system, a wind system. So we're seeing a lot more of a a real holistic approach with respect to making sure that our evaluation of the powerhouses will include whether a wind system can be integrated into that, but making sure that the powerhouse is the first priority for some of these smaller communities. In addition, I appreciated the committee's comments with respect to how this is translating from diesel displacement to actual benefits to ratepayers and to communities. So we have been working to make sure that we encourage all the grantees to understand that we will be after them to provide data so we can report in a most comprehensive manner possible to the legislature to make sure that folks understand what's working, what may not be working, and how we can improve the program. But we definitely need long-term data information coming in from projects that were completed, so we want to make sure that we continue, even projects that are completed now, we want to continue collecting that data for at least 5 years, if not longer, to continue to evaluate the performance of the systems. And again, we need to make sure that we continue to monitor the technical performance of the projects and also provide technical assistance where necessary. And again, especially in the rural communities that may not have the resources to do some of that independently.
Okay. Does that conclude your presentation? Do we have any final questions? So if you could get back to the committee then, I guess, response to those, and then maybe get back with some information on the Emerging Technology Fund and the status of that, the balances and what's going on.
Real quickly, Mr. Chairman, on the Emerging Energy Technology Fund, we are soliciting applications for that fund right now.
Okay. With that, I'd like to thank AA for coming forward, and we look forward to response, and then if we need to have you come back, and we'll let you know. If not, we'll just do it in our office meetings. But we might invite you back to go over some of these issues before now and the end of session. Okay, we'll have a brief at ease while we set up for the next presentation. Thank you. on the record. We're going to continue our presentations today with the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Bob Brand, Director of Research and Rural Development, is here along with the Program Officer, John Anderson. But if we run short of time, we'll figure out if we're going to start at 1 or 1:30 at the end. What I don't want to do is just rush through the presentations, because we have time to make sure that we go through these, because there's it's good that the committee has the time to walk through these at a reasonable pace and not just superficially go through at 30,000 feet. So go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take us through the presentation, and we'll follow the same format. We'll let you do a slide, and then if we have a question on the slide, I'll stop you to have the committee member ask questions. If not, we'll just go on to the next slide.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Good morning, members of the committee. Good morning also. My name is Bob Breen. I'm the Director of the Research and Rural Development Division at Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. And here with me is my colleague, John Anderson, the Weatherization Energy Conservation Officer for AHFC as well. And I believe online we have Dan Fowsky, our CEO, is online as well, listening in. Without further ado, Mr. Chairman, I will be succinct and get right into the slides and see where we end up here. Basically, I'll start off with a weatherization program. This program has been assisting homeowners for some 30 years. It is income-based. Homeowners and renters may apply. Services provided at no cost by 17 different providers around the state, and we have a strong history of performance statewide. In 2008, when we received an infusion of money, we expanded our contractors from 5 to 17 statewide. And just as a general note, this program has created or retained some 1,500 jobs, is our best estimate around the state. The average expense per unit, we have two different categories that we operate on around the state. On those communities that are located on the road or marine highway system receive anywhere between $7,000 to $11,000 per unit. In communities where we have air or barged freight only, we're looking at $1,800 to $30,000 per unit. And what we do is we allow the contractor to do averaging in the region. For example, they might put $1,000 into one home and maybe $5,000 into another, but we do allow them a flexibility to do averaging within the region that they're working. Each home is different. Sometimes they have to do more work on a roof versus the walls or whatever, so we give them that flexibility, and they appreciate that, and it gives them the ability to perform a better service.
We have a question from Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Bob, it seems to me like using Southeast Alaska Marine Highway System and Goon and doing weatherization in Angoon has got to be a heck of a lot more expensive than doing weatherization in Wasilla, say, but you're including them in the same bunch.
Through the chair, Senator Ingham, would you like me to take that one?
Well, I think just generally what we've done is we've looked at the cost of freight, taking into consideration the marine highway system. And so far we've found that generally that amount seems to work fairly well in Southeast. Now, there are some instances where we have had requests to take a look at the per unit basis, but everything that we're hearing from our contractors, they are fairly comfortable with the freight reduction that is provided by the Marine Highway System.
So, Mr. Chair, so you're saying that there are the Marine Highway System is allowing a freight reduction for these AHFC weatherization loans,
Mr. Chairman, through the chair, it's a reduced rate using the Marine Highway System. It costs less to provide freight to communities that are connected by the Marine Highway System than other communities.
Thank you.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
This is something that we, in 2008, this is just a snapshot of what we, a policy decision that we made when we received an infusion of funds. We moved the median income level to 100% of median income, whereas before we were using 80% of median income, which was the HUD standard that was allowed in the state. So, for example, you can see the chart basically speaks for itself. At this point, one person earning $59,700 or less in Anchorage is eligible. The DOE level was $25,080, so increasing that median income limit was a positive thing for people that were being hit by high fuel prices around the state. So it was a good thing to do, and we're fairly comfortable with that. But we just thought we would throw that median income table out there so you knew what table we were using statewide.
And DOE is an acronym for what?
U.S. Department of Energy, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah, thank you.
This just kind of gives you a snapshot of the number of communities that we are providing weatherization service in around the state. In 2008 through 2010, we did a lot of residential weatherization training. The model that we try to use with our contractors is that they hire, they'll bring in lead people and hire locals to actually do the work. So, I think that's important to talk a little bit about because it does provide jobs in situations where there might be limited employment otherwise. So it is has every bit as much value as a jobs program as it does an energy conservation program in the field. We've trained 100 plus Alaskan communities in industry specific residential weatherization services. So we've done some training through the Alaska Works to do trades training and skills in the carpentry trades, that kind of thing. In 2008, we were in 56 communities. In 2009, we were in 90 communities. 2010, 100 plus. 2011, 100 plus. And 2012, 100 plus communities. So.
And we'd like to let record reflect that Senator Hoffman showed up just because he cares, I'm sure. The waiting list in these communities, can you give us kind of a, unless you're going to do it later in the presentation, give us a rundown on what kind of waiting times and differences around the state people may be facing?
Certainly, Mr. Chairman, we'll do that in a couple of different pieces. I'll have John talk about the home energy rebate program and the waiting list on that a little bit later in the presentation. But in terms of the weatherization program, we have each of our contractors go out and do their intake surveys in the springtime. That's usually March and April that they do those intake surveys. And typically there's no problem filling up the waiting list or finding people who are eligible for the program. So we get a jump on that and get everybody pre-qualified in the springtime and then get them on the list to actually go out and do the weatherization. So, you know, that one, because it's income-based, we really have had no difficulty getting people on that list. What's been interesting over time, Mr. Chairman, is that we've commissioned a housing needs assessment studies in the past, and what we found is with the amount of money that we've had in the weatherization program over the years, we really haven't been able to keep pace with population growth. So we're actually seeing income-eligible families outpace the rate at which we were able to do weatherization around the state. In 2008, when we received the large infusion of cash for the program, we estimated that we would be able to address, at best-case scenario, 10% of the current need and eligible homes across the state. Since then, we have been fortunate enough to receive additional amounts of money over the few years since 2008. But that just kind of gives you an idea of what we're up against in terms of trying to be responsive to population growth and low-income families. So
we anticipated in 08, in best case scenario, we would do 10% of the homes that were in need. So in terms of a waiting list for this program, we've always got more people on that list than we can actually serve. But we are ramped up right now to do about $60 to $70 million worth of work per year through 17 contractors.
And if you could get back to the committee on the, if you have them broken down by communities, how many people have requested help and that are waiting. We're just kind of curious to see where the challenge areas around the state is as far as servicing the needs of the people.
Certainly, Mr. Chairman. You know, one dynamic that we have run into over the years, in particularly in Bush, Alaska, is the issue of overcrowding, where we have multi-generations living in single household until there's more readily available housing in the community. So in those cases, you know, that kind of skews the number. In some instances, you would think that we've gone into a community and done everybody and every home that was eligible, only to find that in a couple of years later, when there is new or additional housing stock in the community, that those multi-generational households, it's a, you know, a group of the family might move into a new house, so you now have another family that is eligible for participation in the program. But we certainly get those numbers for you and get as close to the specifics on that for you, Mr. Chairman.
Senator Olson.
I'm just looking at this map here, and I'm assuming it's not all-inclusive with all the arrows that are there.
Certainly not, Senator. It's just,
I see nothing up the Kobuk Valley and certainly nothing around Ulaklik that's there. While I see all the red,
yeah,
red arrows down in another guy's district. I want to point that out to the people, but it's there.
Certainly, Senator, I appreciate your observation. This was more for a visual effect, I guess. But, you know, we can actually come up with a specific list of communities and how many units we've done in each community as well. So if that's something that the committee would like, we could certainly come up with that.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah. Go ahead and continue.
The weatherization program has been funded at these particular levels here. In fiscal year 08, we received $200 million. In fiscal year 2011, $64 million, so for a grand total of $264 million into the program.
Go to the next one. Yeah. And this next slide really kind of breaks that dollar amount out. You can see as of December 31st, 2011, we have expended $144 million. We've completed 5,649 units. We do have units in the pipeline since then, of course, so that the next projected totals that you see there are as of March 31st, 2012. We will have expended $164 million. We will have done over 7,600 units. And I'd like to point out also that we are currently in the process of rolling approximately $60 million out right now in the form of grants to 17 entities around the state to do additional weatherization, which would bring us up right close to the total $245 million to be expended, with the estimated total units to be completed around 10,500 units statewide. The benefits of the program, bear with me, Mr. Chairman, I've got my slides out of order here in my package. Basically, the residents' health and safety, fire safety, it improves the building stock so that it lasts longer, it creates jobs, and it invests in the local community's infrastructure, and as well as providing energy savings. And again, we think that we've conservative estimate is that we've created and retained approximately 1,500 jobs statewide with this program. When this program really came on in 2008, we were seeing the construction industry lagging. We were hearing a lot of conversation about through the trades sector that
people were they didn't have the work that they anticipated they would have. New housing starts were down. New construction was down. And so this program coming online in 2008 really gave an opportunity for people who were in the trades to apply their trade and stay working. Basically, we heard from a lot of companies that said that they were able to keep crews on that they normally would have laid off otherwise just because the market was down. So retention of jobs was a big deal statewide across the state. Utility bills are much more manageable. There was some discussion earlier about those aspects. Fuel consumption is reduced, which means lower dependency on fuel imports. Reliance on state subsidies such as PCE was reduced, and reduced emissions of carbon dioxide was reduced as well. I wanted to, Mr. Chairman, you know, there's always a question about how does this translate into the value to the consumer? And what we're seeing is, on the average, about 30 to 33% savings to the consumer by the kind of fixes that we're implementing with this program. And we're currently generating those numbers across the state. But just to give you a snapshot or an example of energy savings in a community, we got some data from the Aleutian Island Housing Authority. And they had some houses in Atka on the Aleutian Islands. They compiled 12 months of measured energy usage before and after the weatherization services on 13 homes out there. And the data collected was collected in 2008 and 2009, and then again in 2011. And the homes recorded a 43% energy reduction in their gallons of fuel used. This translated into their fuel use went from 10,481 gallons to 5,998 gallons on 13 homes in Atka. Well, you can extrapolate. You know, we have regions that are much colder than Atka. We also have regions that have different wind regimes, that kind of thing. But that's just an example of the kinds of savings that can occur by going into a home and tightening it up and looking at its heating system, looking at its HVAC system. And that's you know, out there we're seeing 43%, but typically the average across the state is between 30 and 33% savings on the work that we're doing in residential homes across the state. And as I mentioned, Mr. Chairman, we're working on translating that to BTU saved. We'll do a conversion and we'll convert that to gallons saved across the state. And once we crunch that, those numbers, we'll make those available to the committee as well. But we know it's going to be a good number. You're looking at 4-year payback on your investment in every home that we're doing. And this also applies to the home energy rebate program as well. So if we can pay off our activities in that home in 3.5 to 4 years, everything thereafter translates to significant savings to the consumer and to the state of Alaska in terms of energy used. It's a pretty healthy number. Next program is the Home Energy Rebate Program. I think I'd like to turn that over to John Anderson. He is actively involved in that day to day, but I just want to, before I do, I want to reemphasize that 30 to 33%. We're seeing that consistent throughout both programs. And in fact, in the city of Anchorage, what we have done is we've gone back and looked at our data and truthed it with data that we're seeing from NSTAR, and it looks like we're right on target with that estimate of savings in Anchorage, where we can actually measure it against actual utility use. So, you know, we might be 2 to 3% off, but we're still coming in right at right around 30%. John.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you.
Hold
for
it
the
opportunity. Senator Thomas?
Just one quick question, the same question as we went through in the last presentation. Are we talking about net savings then? That's my understanding what you're talking about. When you talk about the 25% to 30% or whatever, that's looking at this through a simplified form that you may have filled out by the people on an annual basis that shows what the fuel that brings it forward from the year before any changes were made to the following years, not necessarily factoring in anything about the weather, but actually the savings of electricity and fuel over the period of time based on what the new system actually is producing.
That's correct, Senator Thomas. You know, we don't have any control over how many times the kids run in and out of the front door, but when we look at utilities and overall performance of a house, it is pretty hard measurements on these savings. And we wanted to be sure of that in the Anchorage area, which is why we checked it against utility bills, and it is fairly consistent that we're coming right in at that number.
Thank you.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, through the chair. For the weatherization program, just to clarify for people listening, this is 100% and it's income-based, correct? 100% is paid by the state.
Senator McGuire, yes, and it's based on 100% median income.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. And just two follow-up questions. There have been some proposals floating around this body about handing out rebate checks again. And one idea I have would be to put money into this program as a method of assisting homeowners as opposed to giving them a check that could be spent on consumer goods that are unrelated to energy. And to that end, you mentioned to the chair that you don't have a backlog in this particular program. And I wanted to know if we were to put another, say, $100-150 million into this program that's income-based and reaches everyone in the state, what would it take to ramp up the program to meet the needs of the Alaskans that would qualify?
Thank you, Senator McGuire, for the question. We are currently ramped up to do about $100 million worth of business per year currently. So the ramp up we are there, Senator, and I think, you know, that translates into cost savings if we don't have to those mobilization costs. So we're there, and it wouldn't get any cheaper to mobilize than it would get right now. And I think you mentioned various proposals this year being out there. We've seen those and we've heard about those. What we like to do is look at the residential energy savings from the performance of the entire home, rather than just looking at a furnace replacement program or a program that is very specific. If for both the weatherization program and the home energy rebate program, we require a home energy rating going in, what we call a pre-home energy rating. We then do a inventory list of fixes to do to the home that would translate in certain percentages of energy savings. And then once those fixes are done, we come back and do a post rating. So our critical measurement is the difference between the pre and the post energy rating. And that's really the proof of the pudding. And when we do that, we look at the entire house. We don't just look at a furnace. We don't just look at windows or air sealing. We look at the entire house altogether. And that's what really translates into those 30-33% savings at the end of the day. If all we were doing was focusing on one element and not the entire house, you may not see those savings at 30-33% at the end of the day. For example, if you put a fine furnace in the home but didn't address air sealing, you would still have high utility bills in that home.
And if I, just my last question.
Go ahead.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. On page one, discussing the weatherization program, bullet point three states that homeowners and renters may apply. And I'd just like to hear you talk about that. That's been one of the arguments for handing out checks as opposed to coming in and retrofitting, is that there are renters who have energy bills and aren't the beneficiaries. So could you discuss a little bit about your program as it applies to renters in the state of Alaska?
Certainly. Thank you, Senator, for the question. Renters are eligible to apply. It is income driven. It applies to their residents. We also require an agreement with the landlord that the landlord will engage that tenant. For example, we don't go in and do the fixes, and then the following month that tenant is not evicted and the rent jacked up so that somebody else can move in and pay more rent. We do sign an agreement with landlords to hold them to the bargain that if we're going to come in and do actual fixes to their their property, that they need to make a commitment to that family that's currently living in the unit for a period of time so that they receive the actual benefit of the fix.
Excellent. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
I think, well, any other questions on the authorization program? What we're going to do is we're going to go to at ease until, does 1 o'clock work for you guys?
Certainly.
Till 1 o'clock, and then we'll pick up so we have the full home energy rebate program presentation intact rather than do two or three slides and stop. So we'll stand at ease till 1 p.m. today. We're at ease. Record. This is the afternoon extension of this morning's meeting that started at a minute after 9 a.m. on, I think it's the 27th today.
It is the 27th of February.
So with that, we're going to have a presentation from Alaska Housing with the Home Energy Rebate Program, which we didn't complete this morning. So if you can go ahead and introduce yourself for the record, who you represent, and then take us through the slides, and we'll try to knock it out in a half an hour if we can. Okay, go ahead.
Yes, sir. Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. For the record, my name is John Anderson. I'm the weatherization and project officer for Alaska Housing Finance Corporation. Appreciate the opportunity to testify. We're going to go ahead and just jump right into the slides above. Home Energy Rebate Program, you guys know is out. Oh, I'm sorry.
I think without... It's not going to be televised. You know, they might be picked up on the internet, but it's not going to be televised because the cameras aren't here. So we could accelerate through some of the high-level slides because the committee's, you know, fairly in tune to the energy program. So okay, we can kind of tailor it for the audience.
Okay. Then real quick on this one, the Home Energy Rebate Program was intended to be basically eligible for anyone that wants to participate. It is not an income-driven program. We do have the restrictions that you cannot participate in both programs, the weatherization and or the Home Energy Rebate Program. That was just a fair and equitable issue. It is required to have an as-is and a post-energy rating to participate through the program. The next slide is our funding levels. In 2008, there was an original $100 million appropriation, and then 2009 in the supplement, we were given an additional 60. Last year, an additional 37.5, which takes us to the 197.5 million. To date, since January 2008, we have given out 16,098 rebates as of the date on the slide, which is January 30. Which totals $102.6 million as-is rebates of $28,365 and 9.2. Goes down the post ratings, $2.8 million. And our five-star plus program is a kind of neat little incentive that's out there that we're encouraging the best built home that we know of that exists in the nation, which is, or especially in Alaska, which is our five-star plus. It's the most energy efficient home out there, and we've done 1,317 rebates across the state. Our wait list, this goes back to a previous question with the weather.
Hold it there for a second.
Sorry.
Senator Ellis.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. How does the five-star comport with the Alaska Craftsman Home Program standards? Are those the same or similar?
Through the chair, Senator Ellis, actually those standards are ours. Even the ones that refer to the Alaska Craftsman Home Program. It is the B standard, where the star rating and the point system comes from. It is all based on our ACORM software.
So what does that mean?
That the standard that's out there with the rating process is AHFC's. It all comes out of ACORM.
If I could, Mr. Chairman, Senator Ellis, Over the years, we developed our software, our ACWORM software, and Alaska Craftsman Home was actually a participant in helping us develop those that rating software and the factors going into that. So what they use to train their people and people in the trades is the ACWORM software. It's the same software that we use to measure all of the houses that we weatherize, that we do rebates on, and new construction that is built. And it does have a table included in there that allows builders and people in the industry to measure up to and beyond, actually, 5-star plus. But really, when you get out to 5-star plus, it's pretty difficult to do more fixes that get you beyond that point.
Okay, so in other words, the 5-star program HFC has designed in collaboration with Alaska Craftsman Home folks meets or exceeds Alaska Craftsman Home standards. You all have worked together and collaborated over the years to exceed the original Alaska Craftsman Home standards. Okay, thank you.
The next slide is our wait list. Currently, right now, for the Home Energy Rebate Program, there are 1,746 as of 1/27/12. We are currently still dispatching 500 names monthly through that program. This wait list and the dispatch is really a translation of the funds being fully encumbered through the program of what we've already paid out the door or people that are still in the queue through their 18 months to participate in the program. So we are currently running 63, almost 64% participation in the program. And as people expire or they close or choose not to go through the program, that is how we are basing our release of waitlist consumers, and it's still averaging 500 names per month. Program snapshot, the average income costs for 15,906 homeowners. There is an average of a little over $11,000 by consumer spent. The average rebate amount is $6,375. That includes a $325 rebate for your post rating or your as is, and it's $175 for your post. The homeowner investment is still averaging $4,134. Back to the original intent of the bill, Senator Hoffman stated that when this thing or one of his intention was to have some skin in the game, and I believe that we've achieved that greatly. So the next slide is our savings with our database. Its nickname is ARIS. It's called the Alaska Retrofit Information System, and we will be releasing a couple reports to you very shortly, hoping to have them complete by the end of the month, one for the Home Energy Rebate Program and one for the Weatherization Program, that verify these numbers. It is separated out by election district. And this is the overall statewide average of 33% energy reduction. And based on 9/30/11 data, the cost is a savings of $1,297 per year on average.
So do you see much of a differential between, like, the people in Anchorage that are on natural gas compared to the people in the hydro areas compared to the people that are in the totally non-hydro Western Alaska on their payback times and their percentages?
Mr. Chairman, that is correct. This data will support that and show you the differences. One of the things that is kind of interesting, the average is very similar across the state as far as investment per homeowner or per consumer, but the energy savings is definitely different. We're showing more energy savings in Southeast Alaska than we are in northern part of the state, and we believe it's just a condition of the existing housing stock, how old they are. It's almost, I don't want to say easy because it's not an easy program, but they're a lot easier to fix up and tighten up because they're such an old structure.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm assuming climate comes into the equation as well, right? I mean, it's a heck of a lot different in general Alaska versus Fairbanks, Alaska.
Absolutely, Senator. The heating degree days come into play in all of the factors as well.
So even with that, you still see a significant difference between Southeast and Western Alaska.
Yes, in fact. And Mr. Chairman, if I might, to take that a little, one step further, in that, you know, originally we tried to calculate savings based on cost of heating homes, and we realized very quickly that that was an impossible task because different types of energy sources were changing so frequently. An example, the cost of heating fuel. And so what we then did was we went back and we relegated our research to energy savings in terms of BTUs, and we've done all the conversions for fuel types. But Senator Egan, you're absolutely correct in that there's no way that we can track that, but what we can look at is the age of houses, the heating degree days, the conversions of fuel types so that there's a common denominator throughout the fuel types. So that's the report that John was referring to earlier, that we will be cranking that data out and make that available. I think the next slide that John is going to talk about has some examples that are very very interesting samples about the kinds of savings that can be generated. But in answer to the question, Senator Egan, yes, in fact, heating degree days plays a big part in how much actually can be saved out there and how much your fuel is actually costing you.
All right, too, in Southeast, if you have a tight, older home, it's going to be rotten and fall down. So you want the air to blow through it. Senator Egan.
As long as the Tyvek on the other side. Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I'm assuming that you're using heating degree days and the price of fuel in all your calculations statewide.
Correct.
I mean, you're using the same formula in Southeast Alaska versus the formula in Galena or in Southwest Alaska.
Correct. The big differing factor would be the heating degree days. Okay. You know, some places you have wind regimes where other places you don't. That's a factor as well.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Ironically, Mr. Chairman, years ago we actually had a healthy debate with the builders in the city of Ketchikan about vapor barriers and actually how to install them. And in fact, when you're in a damp climate, there are some things that you do differently so that that vapor barrier actually doesn't cause rot in your structure.
Right. Can you go ahead and continue?
Thank you. So this next slide is really the telltale of part of the discussion you guys are having and information that does come out of ARIS. To date, with all of the data for the Home Energy Rebate Program as of September 30th, we estimate that we have saved 1,649,000 BTUs. A net reduction, of course, in carbon dioxide of over 100,000 tons. Average 33% energy savings. There's the money. We already talked about that. The as-is rating and the increase of a home is basically going on everyone we touch from a below standard of a 2-star to our minimum standard of 4-star, which we believe has really changed the housing stock, climate, living conditions, and everything in the home. Those numbers equate to barrels of crude oil saved. Equivalency would be 284,000 barrels of oil. Gallons would be over 12 million gallons of number one diesel fuel. It is very substantial just in the Home Energy Rebate Program with this snapshot of 15,000 units that we've touched.
And we hope to run similar numbers for the weatherization program. We're in the process of doing that right now, but we saw these numbers come out of the rebate program, and we think the numbers will be very similar for the weatherization side. It's just that we didn't want to throw those out there until we had confirmed them a little bit better. But once we get that, we will give you a sum total of both programs and what our calculated estimates are of fuel savings.
Could you also bring back to the committee then a cross-reference with the fuel distributors to see if they've seen a corresponding adjustment to the fuel? For instance, we know we do all our fancy analysis and we come up with all these thousands of barrels or gallons, however you want to coin it or measure it, fuel savings. But if in fact there's a lot of fuel savings, we should see that in the fuel distributor's volumes.
Absolutely, Mr. Chairman. That's a key piece of data that we plan to keep zero in on.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I just want to get this straight. So when we order, say, my wife and I order an energy audit, and you audit my home, and the average is two star plus?
Two star.
Is the average?
Two star,
okay.
On the older homes, that's
okay. So then when we replace our windows and do all this stuff that you have recommended, we can get it to 4-star.
Yep.
Or higher.
Through the chair, Senator Egan, it should be fairly easy to achieve, particularly in the older homes. You have a lot to gain, in other words. And typically, that ACWRM rating is a very good tool to give you a list of items, a list of fixes. And you can do as many or as few as you want to do. The rebate is predicated upon the difference between the pre and the post. So the more gains you have, obviously, the greater your rebate. We're seeing, about an average of a little over $6,000 rebate on the program on most of these homes. So, we have had situations where the consumer comes in and wants to do windows because they have a beautiful view, and that's all they want to do. However, when you look at the rating software, new windows really doesn't give you that many points. However, if you go in and do windows and air sealing and a furnace, now you're talking significant savings in that house.
Follow up?
Mr. Chair, we had an energy audit this summer, and they said that the worst thing in our house was the windows, mm-hmm. because they were aluminum, and our heating system was fine.
Right.
It was very efficient, but our windows were the problem, and yep. So I'm assuming we'll be doing it this summer. Yep. But I'm just curious about how much money we'll save.
You should have that ACWRM rating should give you a calculation. It should give you an estimate of what your savings would be.
I want to hear it.
Aluminum frames are notorious. The ones from that older era, they're very leaky. They don't seal properly. Yeah.
Where it gets really cold and the ice
yep.
forms on the inside.
Exactly.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Yes, go ahead and continue.
If I could add just one thing real quick on confirming fuel data from the vendors. We will try our best with that, but they are not a regulated entity, and it's very hard to get their information. We have and are in the process of mailing out release forms from all of the consumers. We've just sent 15,000 of them out from the rebate program to get confirmation and ask the consumer if they would release their information for us. But dealing directly with the fuel suppliers is very, very difficult to get their information.
Okay. One other quick comment about Senator Egan's and his windows. We thought it was normal in Southeast when I was little to have ice growing inside our windows. We thought that's the way all windows worked in the winter. And now you tell us that that's not the case.
Great place to store to keep your drink cold. Or
we didn't do that when we were little.
The next slide is, for some reason I got out of sync here. Is the information which I've already touched on, which is the 5-star plus rebate program. Again, 1,317 new 5-star homes built across the state. That is a very, very large increase. Prior to 2008, what we've seen, it is about double of the amount of 5-star homes that were built in this same time period prior to 2008. So we believe that the incentive of the $7,500 rebate is really, really working and benefiting to get that best-built product that's out there. We do have a second mortgage for energy conservation up to $30,000. It's a 15-year loan, taxable basis. We have 77 active and 59 completely participated, and I believe that the interest rate today would be right around 4%.
4%. Just as a side note, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee, we have heard some people ask and inquire about what we could do to try to create additional interest in the home energy rebate program. You know, one of the ideas that's been talked about is looking at even a lower interest loan program so that if someone has a rating done but doesn't have the disposable cash at the time to do the fixes, that there would be a program out there that they could go and get a low or zero interest loan of some kind. I'm just theorizing here, but so that they had disposable income to do the fixes, get the rebate, use the rebate towards paying off the loan, and then take care of the rest of the loan themselves. But we've heard a number of stories about people not having the cash right at the time they take that home energy rating and put it in their hip pocket and think, well, I'll get around to that when I'm able to. But we're thinking that if we could provide them a tool that would lead them to do that work sooner on, then that would be a good public policy, I think.
Okay. Go ahead and continue.
The next slide is basically, it's a new program from AHSC. It is our Alaska Energy Efficiency Revolving Loan Fund for public schools, University of Alaska State Facilities, and municipality facilities. This is a program where we use seed money from ARRA stimulus to create and have the availability to go up and bond $250 million for this program. We basically created the process. We created the manual. We utilized, at direction of the governor, we had $8 million to utilize, and Department of Transportation had $10 million. We took our $8 million of this process and went out and benchmarked as many facilities in Alaska as we could in a very short matter of time. And what that means is we went out and gathered there all of the information that we could regarding their energy use on these facilities. Once we got that data back, we are in the process now of doing 350 IGAs, or investment grade audits. It's a similar process to the rebate program, but it is a lot more in depth, where we're going out and doing a very, very detailed energy assessment of these facilities. Out of that, then projects can be created and formed within a contract of the facility owner, an ESCO. They can do it. An ESCO is an energy savings contractor, or they can do these projects themselves. And that is how we get to the stage of getting the loan. Out of that 350 IGAs that are being performed, we have about 60 of them in-house. And I believe that there is a lunch and learn being scheduled for you guys on the economies for the legislature, and I believe that date's going to be set Friday. We have a contractor that we'd really like to sit down with you guys, and it's a presentation on the economies of this program. And the intent behind the program is the energy savings from doing a retrofit on one of these commercial or public facility buildings would basically pay for that project, and in a very short period payback.
Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, there is a key element to this program that we are really standing 100% behind, and that is performance contracting. Mm-hmm. When the assessors are out looking at this facility, we're looking to them to come back in with a proposal for that building that will be based on a performance-based contract. And what that means to us is that if the fixes are done accordingly to that facility, the savings derived from those fixes should be sufficient to cover the loan that comes out of the revolving loan fund. In this way, we hold the auditors accountable, we hold the people that are doing the assessment accountable, and we provide a mechanism for the municipality to actually pay for those fixes in that building through the savings. We don't want at some time later on down the line for someone to walk through the door and ask for loan forgiveness because they didn't do the calculations properly on this thing. It needs to pencil out from day one so that the savings actually pay for the money put into the facility.
Okay, Senator McGuire, you have a question?
Yeah, thank you, through the chair. This was for the members of the table. You probably remember this was part of our energy package that we passed, and we took the stimulus money and leveraged it. It's a great program, but my frustration over the last 2 years has been failure to launch. I can see here the stats. You've got one loan application submitted. And when I talk to schools that are in my office, municipalities, to try and offer this as one solution to reduce their overhead costs, they just aren't aware of it. So I just wanted to hear briefly your thoughts on that and what ideas you might have to get more information out to people in the munis and the school districts so that we can put this program to work.
Through the chair, Senator McGuire. You're exactly correct. This is we embarked on a trail that hadn't been paved for us before, so this was a brand new process. We do believe that we are there. It was very difficult to get the original data, first of all, to go through and actually get the IGA process. But now that we're there and the IGAs are actually starting to come in the door, we are getting very, very aggressive on an outreach campaign. This lunch and learn is part of it. We plan on launching a serious campaign to let everybody know that you can't stop now, that you've got your IGA or the programs out there. We do have a lot of success behind it. The Department of Transportation is very aggressive right now. They have about $7 million worth of projects going on with their portion that's following this same model. The one loan that is in our door right now is the Seward Sea Life Center. We do know that the city of Kenai, we completed three of their audits, and they've already completed a project on three schools. They just didn't use our, they had the money, so they did it, but based on the IGAs. And since then, the city council has passed a resolution requiring all of the facilities that they own to have an IGA in that community. So I believe it's starting to catch steam, but you're right. It was a very burdensome task to basically create it up front to where we're at today. So we are optimistic that it's going to really start getting some legs, and there's huge savings here.
And I think, Senator, if I may, you know, we've led the municipalities up to the brink, and we've gotten them into the audits, which was a big one for them because they were basically kind of leery of getting involved in any kind of loan program without some real tangible results coming back in the form of an audit. Now that we've got those audits done, we've led them to the brink, and it's going to be their turn to pull the trigger on this thing.
Right.
And the audits should will either convince them or not at that point. So that's where we are at today. We, too, would like to see more loans come through the door, but I think we're right at that point now where it's really it's their call now based on the audits.
Thank you.
Senator Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Mr. Green or Mr. Anderson, to follow up on what Senator Giesel was talking about, I guess that, you know, I think it's a tremendous program, but, you know, municipalities especially are working their rear ends off on how to survive, and school districts. And it seems to me like we could do a better outreach. I don't think we're going to solve any problems by having a lunch and learn. I mean, but I would love to attend the lunch and learn, but there has to be some kind of outreach from your division, the department, to try to even let these school districts or municipalities know that these programs are available. I mean, they're, you know, working their rear ends off on trying to survive, and it seems to me like we could do a better job in maybe going door to door, school district, municipality, you know, just to let these people know that this program exists and there's a lot of money out there that we've appropriated that, you know, they can use.
I appreciate the comment, Senator Egan. It's well taken. You know, the moving dynamic that we see even as we're doing these audits is the cost of fuel is moving on us. Mm-hmm. And as you say, municipalities are strapped with trying to just balance the budget and get through the winter. And if the fuel price fluctuates 25 cents a gallon, it could throw their budget totally out of whack. And we're having to contend with those dynamics as we go along here. So it's kind of a moving target. But I appreciate your concern about municipalities and where they're at in terms of complexity and problems.
Okay, go ahead and continue.
Basically, our one of our last slides here is just the benefits to that process, to that program. It goes through energy efficiency investment, reduction in energy costs and usage, increase the economic activity, quality of life. It definitely stabilizes the building, we believe. Enhances durability and value of the facilities. We have home there, but it's kind of a crossover slide. And of course, other benefits. You have a more beneficial social environment within the office. It's more comfortable. It's more steady. Things of that nature.
You need any money? The Finance Committee, it's...
One of the difficult things, Mr. Chairman, if I may, is the outreach. We, AHSC, fortunately, tied to some of our other programs with our are using some of that money for our outreach, but we did not specifically set up funds for any type of an education campaign with this. That would definitely help.
Senator Hoffman has a question.
Yes, have you completed your IGA on Alaska Housing Finance Corporate Headquarters?
Through the chair, Senator Hoffman, yes, we have.
How did that turn out?
It is kind of scary, but we are in the process of replacing our heating and ventilation system right now. Is one of going to be one of our first projects. Anticipated 40% reduction in our energy costs just on by doing that at the HSC headquarters building.
Senator McGuire.
Thank you, and through the chair, you mentioned earlier that one of the barriers to using the home rebate program was that individuals didn't have the capital on hand sometimes. And so we've been talking, I've been talking to you about the possibility of a loan program to that extent. But when we talk about this program, municipalities, school districts, are there programs in place right now that AHFC can lend money in the case of having to partner or to get? I just wonder if that's a barrier too. Besides the IGA, what are the other barriers that you've identified as financing one?
To our knowledge, no. It's a matter of just getting the process. Sometimes you will have an assembly that has to vote on something to get a resolution through. That could be a barrier, but we have, I mean, the Seward Sea Life Center and the city of Seward was kind of a great example for us to go through this process the first time because it's operated by one entity yet owned by the other one, so we had to have back and forth resolutions, and we managed to make that happen. But that could be a barrier, but we don't believe it. I mean, they're basically non-recourse loans, so this is...
And it's 100%. There's no match required?
No.
Okay, got it.
Yeah, the first barrier that we saw, Senator, out there was lack of capacity and technology to do those investment-grade audits, which is why we got into the game to fund those audits, particularly for the smaller municipalities that don't have that kind of wherewithal or money to go out and find a Siemens or a Honeywell to do an assessment on their building. So that's why we got involved in that business to fund those IGAs or the investment-grade audits. Right. But that was a huge barrier, and we've overcome that one at this point.
Do you have any final comments before we close today?
If I could, I would just like to thank you guys immensely for the support for the programs. We've invested approaching upwards of $500 million for this process. We have a huge amount of time and money invested in our ACWORM software and the ARIS database. HB 197 would be a great topper. We introduced that last year to kind of secure that software for these programs so something else couldn't come in here. So other than thank you.
Thank you.
Seeing no further questions, we have concluded today. We'll begin tomorrow again, Tuesday, February 28th. The agenda for the week is kind of in flux. We thought we'd have PFC Energy with us at the finance table for Thursday and Friday, but apparently not because they're going to be heading back to Washington, so we're going to start the capital budget process and work on some of that. So it won't slow us down in our schedule. We're just going to do a little different order. So there will be a little bit flexible as we go through the week. We're adjourned.